I am going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5501, the Department of Administrative Services. And we hope to hear today from the Budget and Management Division, Mr. Hill, the Public Employees Benefit Board, Ms. Thorne, and Facilities Division, Mr. Foster. And so with that, Mr. Hill, would you like to join us? And anybody else that you'd like to bring? Ms. Parker, good morning.
Good morning.
You will notice that we are absent a quorum this morning, but we are going to continue to move through the report in order to try to keep us on your presentation to try to keep us on schedule. I know that one of our House colleagues has particular interest in some aspects of your portfolio, Mr. Hill, and so if I can exercise the prerogative of the chair and put you on notice that you may be back visiting with the whole committee when we're configured as a committee of the whole, that would be great. But for today's purposes, if you would like to state your name for the record and begin your presentation, that would be dandy.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Darren Hill. I'm the administrator of the Budget Management Division. Let's go to page 5. The mission statement is exactly the same mission statement you saw during phase 1, so there's not a whole lot that's changed there. Turning to page 6.
Oh, I'm sorry. The book with the yellow cover, folks. The presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now, we're on.
We're 1, 2, 3, 4th tab down. I'm colorblind, but I'm guessing it's pink. Thank you. Budget Management Division. Okay. My shirt is
you
pink.
Did okay on the shirt.
Thank you.
Yes.
So we're on page 6, I believe. Budget management's core functions start by preparing the governor's recommended budget. There's no surprise there. We also monitor state agency activities and spending to ensure compliance. That's not only governor's policies, but obviously after the legislature has approved things, we make sure that those are also carried out. Providing information, one of our key goals is to provide accurate information on all kinds of statewide budget information. And then we also coordinate the statewide capital financing. If you remember during the introductory full, Greg Jeffrey came and spoke about financing in the state, and that's his program, and he's within Budget Management Division.
By what mechanisms do you provide state leaders and the public with accurate and objective information? What are your portals to deliver that?
Madam Chair, there's various ways. We get phone calls, and we answer calls that way. We have an internet address or an email address that's info for BAM information, and we get internet, so we answer things via the email. The governor's office, legislators, agencies, and the public in general all ask us for information, and so we provide it. You can reply to emails, hard copies, however that works best for them.
Thank you.
Budget management is also responsible for designing and implementation of the Oregon Budget Information and Tracking System, also known as ORBITS, which is the statewide budget system. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through here. We have a policy package to continue that.
I'd like to also know as we move through this, what's the status of ORBITS now? It's been in development for an awfully long time. Is it up and functional? And
sure. Madam Chair, do you want me to quickly give you an update on that?
Please.
I'd be happy to. Back in 1991, there was a statewide financial plan that was approved by the legislature, and it oversaw the creation of a new accounting, statewide accounting system and a new statewide, well, basically all the financial systems. And as part of that, eventually there was supposed to be a budget system. In 1997-99, the legislature approved a pilot project, and we actually brought in a small pilot.
I think we may need to break for just a moment.
Yeah.
Allow the dawning of the orange and black.
Now we're all completely appropriately attired. I won't feel chagrined.
Staff weren't provided times.
Feel chagrined and anxious in the presence of my properly attired colleagues. Please continue.
Okay, Madam Chair. So in 97-99, we had a pilot budget project that came in. We had agencies, go through the budget process with that pilot, and we got some great ideas about what we really wanted. At that time, there was a committee that oversaw the creation of the new budget system, if you will. Then in the 99-01 biennium, we created the core functionality using a vendor out of California.
Thanks.
In the meantime, we had gone and visited other states, seen different applications. We had looked at custom-built. We had looked at some other off-the-shelf packages and those kinds of things. We settled with Legacy Solutions, like I said, a company out of California. In 01-03 biennium, we implemented the system. And so all agencies went through, they're putting their 03-05 budgets through the process. So I like to think that it was a success in that you didn't hear a whole lot about it. And like a referee in a basketball game, when you don't hear a whole lot about them, they're probably doing a pretty good job. The one thing I will say is our initial goal was we wanted to replace the budget system for budget preparation purposes, basically to replace what the functionality we had in the old system first, and it was a step-by-step process. So what we said was, let's take the current system, replace that first with some extra functionality in the first biennium, and then in each biennium beyond that, and we'll start building in more integration with some of the other statewide systems. And so it has actually been up and functioning since 0103. So the 0305 budget preparation was done in there, as was the current 0507 budget preparation was also done in the system. One of the things that you will probably see, and Dallas can probably attest to this, is the Legislative Fiscal Office is actually inputting data into the system this time, much like our analysts do for the governor's rec. They are actually utilizing the system this time. The Legislative Fiscal Officer, Ken Rocco, is one of the two project sponsors along with myself. So they have their functionality and their needs are being met too by this system. So that kind of gets you up to date of where we are.
Thank you.
I can make a comment, Madam Chair?
Please, I would invite that.
It has saved Legislative Fiscal a lot of time in that we are not replicating what we received in the printed budget to do our work. We are able to use that system. A version is provided for us. We log on, have our own, and we are able to use it rather than take that information, put it into our own modified Excel packages, and then try to do work with it. So we are very supportive of it, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much flexibility is there in the system to provide what would be normally called financial accounting for purposes of business decisions?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that is one of the long-term functionalities that we're looking for. Again, if you go back to there was a statewide financial plan, that was one of the things that we looked at as we brought the system up was we had to have like account tables and reporting levels and those kinds of things so that eventually the accounting system and the budget system could talk. Technically, what we found is technically getting the two to talk is a lot easier than breaking down the business barriers that people have of budget folks like things one way and accounting folks like things the other way. We have worked very closely with the Statewide Controllers Division. I think John Radford could speak to that if you'd like. But we have worked very closely on working the two together. We currently have the ability to actually pull on a monthly basis the accounting data into the system so that you can see some year-to-date actuals pulled in with the budget data.
How many agencies, thank you, Madam Chair, how many agencies manipulate your data into financial formats that they deem to be more functional? And this comes from the background, having served on the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee and working with the State Fair, and the problems, and there are major problems that we have there. And where they're trying to take the data that comes from DAS and manipulate it in their shop into some type of meaningful report. And it isn't working. Clearly it's not working. And that's what, from whence the question comes.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the one thing I will say is we are taking this on in steps. To get down to the final gee, I can push a button and get out a great report that matches up everything I need. We're not there yet. It's part of what our package is going to be, and you'll hear a little bit more about that. We're going farther down there. We do have the ability to pull the two systems together. To be able to meet the needs of all 90-some agencies and what they specifically need, it's going to be pretty difficult. I think what we look at there is we try to match up, you know, can you get the core functionality that everyone needs, and then look at the specialized stuff off to the side. What the State Controllers Division has done is, you know, put some information out onto a data mart and allowed folks to extract data that way. I think we would like to be able to have a comprehensive tool that can do everything for everyone. It just isn't real cost effective at this point in time. We are looking, though, at moving further and further down that path. But as we've gone on, we have pulled the data together, but trying to get that final end tool that meets everyone's needs is probably a little bit dicey.
Okay.
Thank you.
Higher Ed is not in this system, are they?
Madam Chair, Higher Education does use the budget system, yes.
Great. Terrific. Okay.
Let's turn to page 11. Significant changes in the past 10 years. Probably the most influential change has been the creation of, or the integration of the capital investment section. Again, that's Greg Jeffrey and his folks into us. That happened in 1996. And again, the reason probably why I would say that's most influential is, as you know, debt has become a much larger piece of the pie and from budget terms. Turning to page 12, we have, as our name would imply, we used to be the budget and management division. And we still are doing management, but we used to have folks that were actually dedicated. And at one point, we had three folks that were actually dedicated to doing management studies out in agencies. With time, we have kind of changed into the budget and management division without having folks specifically looking at management issues. From time to time, we will still have requests from the director's office and from agencies to come help them look at some things. But obviously, our focus has turned out to be mostly on the budget side of the fence. And then we have, as I mentioned before, we have had a significant change in our statewide budget system. The old system was falling apart and had absolutely no integration with the accounting system at all. So we have moved forward on that. If we turn to page 15, the use of professional contracts and purchasing, or I'm sorry, professional services and purchasing contracts. The one of the issues that we looked at with Orbitz was, with buying off-the-shelf software, you don't get a whole lot of flexibility. And some of these nationwide companies, what they'll do is they'll put out a product for you, and then you kind of have to hope that they meet all of your needs when they go to make changes. Originally, it was decided we would pull this buy this off-the-shelf system from Legacy Solutions. They were going to help us customize it, and the code was actually ours. We owned the system itself. What we found after one by name, they helped us, they coded it, got all the modifications done, but we started doing knowledge transfer right away because it became very cost-effective for us to have knowledge transfer and be able to take care of the system on our own rather than continue to have them come from California on an occasional basis, come up here and help us. You know, they would work on it from time to time, but it was much more cost-effective for us to have knowledge transfer and have our own staff here to actually take care of the system. That being said, what we have done in the current biennium is, as the staff, we're kind of winding down, if you will, on the actual creation of new things for this. I think this biennium in 0507 may be the last biennium that we have an actual organized policy package for this. I think we're going to try to integrate some of this back into budget management and have it be more of an ongoing, continuing kind of maintenance, and we'll always be looking to improve it, but I'm not sure we're going to have a full-scale team working on it after this. That being said, what the project manager for the for Orbitz has done is she has looked at her staff for the current biennium, and she's found that it was more cost-effective rather than keeping a state programmer, a state employee programmer on board, to basically have a contract for ad hoc services so that as it was needed and we had emergencies or the workload would increase and her staff could no longer handle it, we would have an ad hoc contract with some folks. So that's what this is talking about here. So we have basically eliminated one programmer position, and you'll actually see that as we talk later on. The other area where we use professional services is for financial, in the financial arena. We have bond counsel, financial advisors, and the trustees. All three of those contracts are with Greg Jeffrey and his folks. Turning to page 19, I want to speak about cost containment activities. We have, by the essential need of having budget shortfalls in the past 2 to 3 biennia, looked at basically all of our processes. And we have constantly modified our business processes based upon the needs of the agencies and the legislative fiscal office and, of course, our own needs. New system functionalities, having the statewide budget system has helped us become much more efficient in cutting down time on audits and even simple things like printing costs and those kinds of things. An example here on page 20 is basically the example that I gave you before about talking about the professional services contract. The other thing I will say is our office manager is a bird dog when it comes to printing costs and contract costs. She has gone through all of our contracts with our vendors. She's gotten our set us also our default duplex printing, those kinds of things. And they're little things, but they do add up. With that, let's turn to page 25. Budget issues and cost drivers for us, they would be the things you would probably expect. Initiatives and those kinds of things drive our costs and our needs for services constantly. One of the reasons why we came up with Orbitz is it's much more flexible than the old system that we have. So when folks want to start looking at budgets in a prioritized fashion and those things, we have the systems that can adapt to those rather than paying people to come in and program them and do those kinds of things. They're much more table-driven. And then Orbitz project debt service. When we start going through the numbers here, you're going to see that our assessments go up fairly significantly. In fact, on the next page.
Senator Morissette.
Speaking of legislative initiatives, okay, these are not citizen-sponsored initiatives. These are...
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's correct. Okay, I'm talking about the needs from the legislature and the governor's office.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, in just thinking about the magnitude of the Orbitz initiative and what licensing may accompany it, what highly specialized programs we have, how captive are we to the company that helped design and implement this in terms of licensing, maintenance, long-term support of the system? I'm trying to get a sense of the shelf life of Orbitz and what investment we'll have to make in it to keep it viable.
Madam Chair, let me defer to Pat, but we're completely out from that. We owe nothing back to the company on licensing or anything. It's our system. We own it. We can do with it whatever we want.
And in terms of its, for lack of a better word, one-offness, maintaining it, keeping the right people cross-trained to deal with it, all that's in place?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's what our project, she has been licensed by the state as project manager, and that's what her task has been.
Okay, and she decides to move to Madagascar.
Madam Chair, she has an assistant project manager who's worked on the project. We have other
I can
state
see
staff.
That faraway look in her eyes.
Well, as a matter of fact, she's about 6 months from retirement, so she's probably pretty close to that. But in all seriousness, there are other state staff that can come in and oversee those things. Plus, she's got a complete staff that has been involved in the project for quite some time.
Thank you. Representative Rocky.
I was thinking maybe you were heading towards the issue of like software upgrades or as technology changes over the years, how that affects this and what kind of financial investment you would need to keep it up to date.
Madam Chair, Representative Lockheed. Those are issues that will always be looked at. We have done some upgrades to the actual database itself. It's an Oracle database, and there have been some upgrades to those that have been fairly seamless for us. But we will be working with IRMD over the years to make sure that we're set up for those things and prepared for those.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would you consider to be the economic life of this investment?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, at this point, it's real hard to tell. I would say that being a legacy type system, I would think that 20 years would be a minimum.
Okay, thank you. The question that I have would be directed to Dallas. In looking at the scheduled debt repayment, we have 3.2 in this upcoming biennium, and then it falls off, and then eventually the debt is retired. There may be a rationale to consider refinancing that debt. Has that been considered?
Do you want to address this or show? I'll take it on because it involves more than just this debt, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Whenever there's an advantage to the state, economic advantage, I think the margin is savings of 3% to refinance, then the capital investment working with Treasury undertakes those reinvestments. They have the statutory authority to do so and then report back to the legislature. These may be such a short shelf life because the COPs provide ownership to the in effect, we're renting. We issue COPs only for the assets acquisition or development. So, and these are very short-lived, and I'm not sure if the refinancing is economically viable on these very 5 years usually. But they can address this better than I for these specifically.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, Greg Jeffrey, who is also here, he's the guy who would be able to say whether that is an economic advantage for us to do that or not.
Let's invite Mr. Jeffrey up to the table, please. Thanks, Cora. Good morning. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Jeffrey. I'm the finance manager with the Department of Administrative Services. over the past 15 years, the COP program has refinanced about 10 times. Various outstanding certificates of participation. The other policy that we practice is when we're talking about financing IT projects, the repayment term is between 5 and 7 years. It's really driven by what the economic useful life, which would address the ideas of, major upgrades, potential upgrades to the software, things like that. I do believe in a recent refinancing of some portion of the COPs that are outstanding, there was a slight refinancing done, for a part of some of the Orbitz COP financings that was outstanding. But as Dallas said, when the repayment term is in that kind of really relatively narrow 5 to 7 year time frame, there's not a great opportunity, to realize, a great deal of savings.
Follow up.
Of the $3.2 million, what percentage of that is general fund in the repayment interest principal?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think kind of as a rule we've said about one-third of our budget comes from general fund. This is all repaid by assessments. It's assessments that we assess out to all state agencies. But approximately, I'd say, Dallas, is that right? One-third of the assessments is
about one-third would be general fund.
General fund.
Okay. Well, you have looked at it then.
Look for opportunities to refund, any part of our COPs, lottery revenue bonds, any of the debt we're responsible for, yes.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Hill.
Okay, Madam Chair, let's turn to page 26, and we were already kind of looking at page 27. As you can see, our assessments are expected to go up by $2 million in 05-07, and that seems as a percentage as a very large percentage. If you look at page 27, though, as Senator Morse has already pointed out, what you can see here is, as the legislature has approved our financing over the years, we have issued COPs. This happens to be the one, 05-07 is the one year where we're actually paying on all three, or one biennium, I'm sorry, that we're paying on all three of them. As you can see, by far the largest one, the initial COP, will be paid off in 05-07. And you can also see that next biennium, we would expect our assessments to go down significantly as we no longer have very much debt service. Page 28 shows our budget. Again, I think probably the biggest thing here is you can see that debt service is the fairly sizable chunk of our budget as you look at 05-07. Page 29 again shows you where other funds here, but as Senator Morse also pointed out, obviously some agencies pay our assessments with the general fund. On page 30, the governor's recommended budget continues core functions. It continues the development of orbits, which is our package 321. And other than that, all it is just the standard inflation for personal services and supplies. Page 31 shows you that we're actually asking for one FTE less than we have in the current biennium. As I stated before, that's the programmer position, which we now have a contract for as needed professional services. Looking at these next few pages, Cora really wanted to go through these essential packages, but there's not a whole lot there. Did you want to cover them, Cora?
No.
Okay.
Same as yesterday. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer questions.
The one package I guess I would point out is package 022, which is our phase-out. What we have done by means of our budget is we have always phased out the orbit's development and then asked for it back in a package. So we've always allowed the legislature as a policy decision to renew the Orbitz project. That being said, if we turn to page 35, there is our Orbitz development package. Again, it is one limited duration position less than we have in the current biennium. It's asking for $1.9 million of expenditure limitation. Turning to our performance measures, I want to say a couple of quick words about that. Senator Morissette was kind enough after phase one to catch me out in the hall and give me some ideas of some outcome measures related to the Orbitz project itself. As I mentioned at that time, we have two performance measures, one of them being a budget index that's put out by a national organization. So many things are a part of that index that we have no control over, such as rainy day funds and the way we invest and some other things like that, that I didn't think that was really a fair measure. I think in good times we got good scores, and I think in bad times we get bad scores, which isn't a true measure of our division. The other one we have is a customer satisfaction survey where we try to get 80% of each of the there was probably about 10 or 12 questions on there about the services that we provide. The latest survey came in, and we were at about 81%. And I think customer satisfaction is a good thing, but I frankly got some very good comments from folks that we'll be following up on. But what I have done since phase one is I took Senator Morissette's suggestion, and I've really gone and talked to my technical folks that work around the orbits. And they're starting to look at some of the measures that we could look at, such as how much time we're saving, and not only internally, but also how agencies are saving money using this new statewide system. The other thing we have done is we have contacted several other states and looked at both the legislative side and the executive branch for the kind of performance measures that those folks have. It's kind of a busy time right now because most folks have budgets going on, and so we're still gathering some of that information. But I've also talked with Ken Rocco, and he's interested in gathering that information so that potentially there are some areas where his office and my office would have like performance measures.
Okay.
With that, I think I'm done, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the panel with respect to Mr. Hill's presentation? Okay. Thank you. Well, this meeting was not posted as public testimony. I don't know if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to offer any testimony. I was going to take a break right here and see if there was. There being none, we would invite Ms. Thorne forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
No.
No. Good morning. I'm Jean Thorne. I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm assuming you're on phase two for Public Employees Benefit Board. Just to recap, page five, our mission, provide a high-quality plan of health and other benefits for state employees at a cost affordable to both employees in the state. We have specific statutory authority laid out in statute for the board itself. A reminder, the board is an 8-member board, 4 management, 4 labor, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and I serve at the pleasure of the board. On page 6, the core functions, design, purchase, and administer health and other benefits for state employees. And just to be clear, what you will see is in our budget, it does not include the actual dollars spent on health care benefits. People talk about PEB's budget sometimes as referring to all of the dollars that are actually spent. Those dollars are in agency budgets, and I think you have a handout that you talked about earlier. So the PEB budget really is focused on the administrative tasks of running the program, as well as some reserves, which I'll get to in a moment. In terms of statewide business change initiatives, we are almost done with implementation of what we call PEB.benefits. We have one module left to come up, which is the member module, and that will be up by the end of June. We've had a very paper-based system in the past, and so although eligibility may be entered by agency staff on one system and premiums may be entered on another system, that when it comes down to actually informing the various carriers of who all are the dependents, for instance, an employee's family, that's purely been paper. The agency staff have to take that paper, keep a copy, send it off to the carrier. So if you're a new employee, for instance, they may be enrolling in medical, in dental. Well, they would be enrolling in medical and dental, perhaps life insurance, perhaps disability insurance, perhaps long-term care. Every one of those is a separate form that has to be filled out. Some of that is input by the agency staff, and otherwise lots of paper is sent out. Over the past 3 or 4 years, we've worked on bringing all of this together into an electronic system. And I understand there were 17 different state databases that had to be brought together, including carrier databases, in order to do this. But what this will allow now is that the next time we have open enrollment, members will go in and actually enter the information themselves. They can go in and make corrections. It includes all the information on dependents, who's with what plan. It allows agencies to get away from all of the paper that is out there. And for them to, they will have, agency payroll and benefit staff will have less they have to input themselves. It will allow the PEB customer service staff to have access to the same information that agencies have. So as it is now, if a member calls and says, I need to find out whether my, you know, my child is covered on my Regents plan, we have to send them back to the agency. It has to go through the paper. So this information is now on there. The agency payroll and benefit staff now have access to it. We're in a cleanup mode right now. When we put all this together, even though we cleaned up quite a bit before we moved to this portion, but we sent out the confirmation of benefits to all members, and it came off the screens for PEB.benefits. And we found people found they had extra children they didn't know about, and so things like that. So we're cleaning that up now. But long term, this really will help agency staff and I think the carriers as well, because they can electronically pick up these files now once a week.
Senator Morsette.
Now, Jean, of course, that is one of the major performance goals that you will be listing, and so you can come back and really brag about the results. Right.
Madam Chair and Senator Morrison, I think one of the problems will be the efficiencies are really out in the agencies more so than in PEB. So it's very hard for us to be able to capture how much time this may have saved in each agency.
But may I continue? Oh. I think you can craft your performance measure to reflect that. If you have done anything to make this happen, then you should make that as something qualitatively
Chair,
that
yeah.
you've accomplished.
And Senator Morris said, I think we'll take a look to see if we could craft a performance measurement around it. Our problem at this point would be we wouldn't have baseline data to show how much time it took with the paper-based system.
May I
please?
Performance measures are, to me, a very important accountability tool, and I think that you have to be sure that you include those things, because those are kinds of things that I think we want, you know, we can be proud of, you can be proud of, and the citizens can be proud of, that you're documenting an effort to save, you've initiated it, the other departments can take advantage of it, and I think that is the kind of thing we want to hear.
I'm sure Senator Morris said we'll certainly go back and see how we might be able to get data yes. around that.
Thank you.
Jane, given the nature of the information that's in the electronic files that you're keeping, what are you doing about security and protecting that data?
Madam Chair, the contractor who's been working on actually putting this together has put significant firewalls in that. Members will actually have... members themselves have less access than the agency payroll and benefit staff may have. Now, the information those staff have is information they've always had, but there will be passwords, for instance, that staff will have to be able to enter in order to access their own information. And there will be reporting out that if changes have been made on a file, who it was made by. So there are a number of firewalls that have been put in place.
Thank you.
In terms of significant changes, as I mentioned last time, PEB actually was established in 1998, so I guess that would be a significant change. There were two boards before then, one which focused on it was the Bargaining Unit Benefits Board, and the other that was State Employees Benefit Board that was for management and not unrepresented. In 2002, the first three or four years, basically the board continued the plans that had been in place by the two separate boards. They did a major consolidation in 2002, moved to initially three, now two carriers, currently Kaiser and Regents. It invested in PEB.benefits, as I noted. The last time I was here, I talked about the Vision 2007, which is really the board's longer-term vision of how to get better value out of the healthcare delivery system. It's really focused on some quality outcomes that the board believes long-term will really help us stabilize some of the cost trends and really allow us to say, you know, we are getting certain kinds of good quality outcomes for our employees for the funding that's been provided. We have an RFP for 2006 that was issued in January for medical plans, and we've received 15 responses. And so we are now in the process of evaluating those responses. There are binders and binders and binders of materials, and the decisions for 2006 are scheduled to be made by the June 21st board meeting.
And the board will act on that based on recommendation from PEB management?
Actually, Madam Chair, the board themselves are very heavily involved in the evaluation process. So they've spent an entire day yesterday going through proposals to start the process. So. In terms of professional services and purchasing contracts, we have a very small, very limited number of staff. We have 17 staff, and so we contract extensively. Obviously, our insurance contracts. We have contracts for medical, dental, long-term care, life, disability, accidental death, and dismemberment. We also have a number of wellness services that PEB sponsors. Those are done through contracts as well. And so if you've ever been across the street to our offices across the street, we have a clinic over there that's subcontracted. The clinic is operated by the Oregon Wellness Center. They also do health screenings at state agencies on site. We have an online tool through WebMD that's available to our members, a newsletter that's contracted out, and then we also, as of January this year, we have a pilot tobacco cessation program for our members, and we contract with Free and Clear, which actually operates the Oregon Tobacco Quit Line, so we piggyback on that. Insurance underwrite, yes?
While I take no exception to the fact that these wellness services are a very good thing, is that fee for service, or how is that paid for?
Madam Chair, there is agencies, and it's been at this rate for several years. Agencies are assessed $2.55 per employee per month. It's been a flat rate that then comes to PEB for these types of services. It comes into the stabilization fund. And so we contract for wellness services utilizing those funds.
So it's $2.50 per employee per month per agency?
Yes.
Do the math for me.
We have, Madam Chair, for a biennium, I believe we're spending close to $3 million on wellness services. We are planning, we had originally planned to go back out on an RFP in 2004 for wellness services, but we are asking the medical vendors who are proposing to look at incorporating a number of elements for wellness services, such as the online health risk assessment. And from our perspective, it makes more sense to tie that more directly to the person's health plan and primary care physician. So we had decided we would wait until we saw what came in on those proposals to determine the scope of what we may want to contract for in 2006 and beyond. So over the next few months, we'll be doing kind of a parallel process of reassessing. And we do have a wellness subcommittee of the board that will be looking at where do we fill in the gaps that with services that bring value beyond our insurance contracts.
I'm just trying to figure out, in such a fiscally constrained environment that we still are operating in, and the admonition of some of our colleagues that until some of the structural problems are resolved in how the state spends money, I'm presuming some of this $2.50 coming from the agencies is general fund, and I'm trying to rationalize why, give me the rationale for why we should be spending $3 million for what some people might think is just personal responsibility. We all know smoking is bad. We all know being too fat is bad. We all know all of this stuff, but give me a cost-benefit ratio for $3 million.
Madam Chair, I don't have an exact cost-benefit
ratio. I know that. We're talking philosophically here.
Tobacco cessation, for instance. We entered into our contract is, I believe, $200,000. The cost of someone who is smoking and that we end up picking up through claims costs is certainly much, much higher than that. And I'm sorry I don't have those. I had the figures in front of me when we were first issuing the contract. But to say stop smoking is easy to say. But providing the kind of supports, both the counseling, nicotine patches, et cetera, to really assist someone to stop smoking is going to pay off for us in the long term. Certainly, we have health classes and health screenings where someone may find they are at risk for diabetes, for instance, and not be aware of that. If we can catch some of that early, if we can help people remain healthy, health is not just an issue of what the doctor does to you. It's what you do yourself. And so I think we've received very good feedback from our members about the screenings, about the classes that may assist them to really avoid seeing the doctor and avoid some of those bills. So long term, we believe there's a real payoff.
How many people at any given time do you have accessing your wellness services?
Madam Chair, I can't give you that number right offhand. We do track screenings, we and the number who are attending classes. the board has really emphasized the last two or three years wanting to get that outside Salem. It had been very much focused in the clinic, which is fine if you're on the mall, but we really have tried to move those out. But I can get that information for you.
This seems to be very much the carrot part of a carrot and stick sort of relationship. If there were savings here and you looked at a different model, for example, some kind of a surcharge on a policy for somebody who smoked or had smoking is the best one because that certainly is something that someone decides to do or not do. I'm just curious how many. What was the genesis of this program?
Madam Chair, my understanding was that this actually came out of before there was PEB, when there was BUB. The Bargaining Unit Benefits Board, they actually operated the clinic. And the clinic at that point was really focused on episodic care, where people would drop by there rather than going to see their physician. The board over the last few years has really said we need to change the focus. I mean, we pay insurance companies to pay for the doctor visits. That what we can do that insurance companies cannot do as well is really try to focus on what kind of supports can we bring to members on site that may make a difference in their health in the long term. One of the things we're doing, and is actually later in the presentation here, we are in partnership with Department of Human Services, their chronic disease prevention programs, and we are, they are actually, they have a company on contract that's fielding a survey to PEB members beginning this week, which will really try to establish some baseline data around their risks, their health risks, their use of wellness services, and their absenteeism and their productivity, at least from their perception, as a result of that. And then the idea would be we will do some follow-up surveys, so we'll get baseline data to be able to see what kind of impact these services really have on the health of individuals. This last summer we did a pilot walking program. It was put together very quickly, but those who wish to participate, they all got a pedometer. Didn't do many steps today yet, but support materials. We had some walking groups, and we did a follow-up survey, and something like 80% of those who participated, we had about 600 people, said they had increased their physical activity as a result of this. We're continuing that. A number of stories of people losing significant amounts of weight, and really those are the kinds of things that will make a difference in the longer term. So I think the board has really tried to take a proactive approach, a supportive approach to employees, as opposed to something that would be more punitive.
Thank you, Senator Morsette.
Well, this was not the reason that I wanted to be recognized, but that would be a good performance measure. But my original question is that it's interesting because you have insurance contracts, and then below you have wellness services. Now, what's the relationship between the two? There should be a relationship.
We have, Madam Chair and Senator Morsette, we have those who operate the wellness services also work closely with our medical insurance vendors. But Frank, there are in the RFP we have had out for medical services, we really are emphasizing there are some aspects of what we're doing now that this is me speaking personally, not for the board, that I think we can discontinue in the future because they're more appropriately housed with the medical insurance plans or the plans with which we'll be contracting, because we need to tie them in more directly, such as a health risk assessment and some of those online educational tools. There are other services that, such as health screenings, where we check blood sugar levels, blood pressure, et cetera, on site.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator. Well, I just want to be sure your answer. I may not have asked the question correctly. Are you getting discounts on your insurance policies because of the wellness program? I mean, is there that kind of relationship? Is there money saving somewhere along the line?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris said, at this point, we are not receiving any kind of discounts because of that. I think employer-based wellness programs are pretty common, and I think where long-term we would hope to see would be reductions in claims, which would then translate into...
Follow-up, please.
The city of Springfield has, as far as I know, still self-insurance on worker comp, and they have a wellness program, and the council always questions, why do you have these machines in the fire stations and throughout the city and so on? And the response was that we save a lot of money by doing that. It is saving us dollars directly because we are self-insured now. What's the status of your insurance negotiations in terms of cost saving? You're in the midst of negotiations. Are you going to save? How much money are you going to save by renegotiating your contracts?
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, as I said, we have 15 proposals in. Some of them, we now, the 2003 session gave us, clarified that we had permission to self-insure. We don't have sufficient reserves to completely self-insure. And we have a mix of proposals, some of which are fully insured, some of which would be self-insurance done on a self-funded basis. And so to the degree it's self-funded, we take the risk then, which means we could potentially get the savings as well. And under our current contract, for instance, with Regents, I mean, 92% of the costs of that contract are based on claims experience. So it's directly related to how much our employees use services, what kinds of services, and what the cost of those services are. So to the degree there's a reduction in that, we would see some of those costs down the road. I think the one thing that we have not been able to get a handle on would be non-claims related costs, but costs related to absenteeism or people who are performing perhaps less than 100% because of underlying health issues. So the survey we're just doing in the field now asks some questions. It's self-reported. But the hope would be by doing follow-up surveys then every 2 years or so, we'd be able to track that.
One more
follow-up.
Are there actuarial data based on the implementation of wellness programs? I mean, it seems to me that someone can project the amount of savings that might be accrued over the year by doing certain programs, which should be reflected, hopefully, in the rates that you get from the insurance company. To me, that there must be a direct connection there somewhere. And maybe that would be down the line somewhere. But just the projection of if you're doing these kinds of programs, then with this many people, with these kinds of risks, there will be savings. And that should be reflected in the rates that you're quoted.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, I don't know that specifically related to wellness. One of the pieces that we also do, and it's not part of the wellness assessment, it's really part of the insurance contracts, but we facilitate the process, is we've had disease management programs required of our contract of Regents and Kaiser for the last 3 years or so. So people, I mean, you have like 20% of the members who account for 80% of the cost. So they may have the areas we focused on are diabetes, asthma, congestive heart failure, and coronary artery disease. And we work, we meet with the medical and disease management staff of the carriers once a month. We have a meeting again tomorrow to try to coordinate those programs. There are projections that can be made in terms of to what degree, but it takes time, what degree helping people with diabetes managing their care will save dollars. So the more you there's general wellness services, and then there are some very focused programs as well.
Thank you. Please continue.
The other areas in which we utilize contracts, insurance underwriting and modeling, we utilize Aon Consulting for that. We will occasionally have expert consultation on coverage issues, such as through OHSU, or we had a contract with Foundation for Accountability. Currently have a contract with Dr. Mark Helfand of OHSU, who is working with us in looking at some issues. And then lastly, third-party administrator services. They handle eligibility for those who are no longer state employees, so those who are on COBRA, so the post-employment coverage or early retirees. They also handle our flexible spending account.
Senator Morsette.
Yeah, before we leave this area, a follow-up on the question that Madam Chair asked earlier about employees' willingness to participate. Maybe you didn't ask that directly, but I will. It would be interesting to put a check off and send it out to all of the PEB employees who take advantage of the wellness program and ask them if they would be willing to pay part or all of the program themselves if they think it is of value. That would be a voluntary contribution to the program. Mm-hmm. And some might think, hey, this is great, and I'm willing to check off $250 a month?
$255.
Yeah. So that might be a way of reducing
the state. Well, for some of the services, asthma management, it might be worth more than the $255. I mean, it's $255 now as a mandatory assessment on all heads and all bodies and all agencies. But certainly this is a service, and it's a convenience to have a clinic located on the mall. Okay, thanks.
Moving on, in terms of how we decide when to use professional service contracts rather than state employees, again, we have 17 staff. Most of those are on the phone with customers. So that's why we do contracts so much. But we would look at, do we have any expertise or resources to do the work, or are there other state agencies who might have that, that we could do it through an interagency contract?
Jean, can I go back again to the clinic? How heavily is it staffed?
Madam Chair, those staff are contracted staff. So I'm trying.
Nurse practitioners, physicians.
Yeah, there's nurse practitioners. I believe there's, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, I believe there may be 3 nurse practitioners and a health educator and maybe a medical assistant. They not only staff the clinic, but they go out and do on-site screenings around the state.
Thank you.
As far as program improvements and cost containment, the way in which we may identify program improvements is member feedback through surveys, and member may also include agency payroll and benefit representatives. We have a specific email for inquiries.peb where people can send questions or ideas in, public comment at board meetings. We had significant carrier and provider input as we developed the RFP for the medical services over this last year. Also suggestions from board subcommittees, PEB staff, consultants, et cetera. So there are a number of things we've done over the years that are kind of on the administrative side, putting more on the website, adjusting the amount of materials we may have and opening packets, et cetera. How we evaluate those program improvements through our annual open enrollment employee survey. Again, ad hoc employee surveys. We are expecting the survey that's being done, that's just beginning to be fielded now, to have a very good confidence rate in that, monitoring customer service contacts and then budget monitoring. Cost containment activities. The first one on here is the biggie, and it really is, again, not in PEB's budget. When we consolidated medical plans in 2002, the estimated savings in that first year was about $40 million, and that's by looking at the bids that were submitted and what that cost would have been versus the contracts that were eventually awarded.
Senator Morsette.
I'm sorry. How much was that?
$40 million.
Oh, okay.
$40 million in the first year. And then beyond that, we have, you know, just inside the agency, reduced some of our subscriptions, a greater use of web-based communications, et cetera. And then our method for evaluating cost containment for instance, the $40 million figure, that was really done underwriting projections from our consultants. And then for the other smaller in-house is just monitoring our budget.
Senator Morsette.
Yeah, and this, of course, is a performance measure, right? Of course it is.
Madam Chair and Senator Morsette, I mean, we can look back and say saved $40 million.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I hate to keep saying this, but I think that we're looking for things that you're really doing right And you got to work those into performance measures. I mean, you know, you're always searching for cost containment, always. And so anytime you find something, show us. We did this. That's, you know, and I think that, because a lot of times people rely, and I, you know, on measuring activities or measuring something you have no control over, but these are things that I think are great. So, thank you.
I guess my only comment would be, it's having lived through the development of performance measures inside the agencies, at one time when I worked at ODOT, we were spending so much time counting the outputs that we forgot to serve the customer. And I relish the opportunity to share agency successes, but I think there has to be a balance in how much you can institutionalize measuring stuff in formal performance measures. And if we can find that balance, great. But encouraging, as you have been so stalwart in doing, encouraging agencies to tell their success stories, whether it's PEB or any agency, I think is a terrific thing.
Moving on to page 25, budget issues and cost drivers. Drivers unique to PEB, just the complexity and the nature of the program when we start talking about healthcare benefits, and especially now as we're looking at potentially self-insuring some of our program, we have a lot more use of Department of Justice services and increased use to consulting services, especially around underwriting.
Give us a sense of the Department of Justice services that you're using.
We have, over the last few months especially, as we've gone out with a request for proposal, and this is, I mean, the dollars that are being spent on health care benefits in state government in 2005 we're projecting is around $435 million. So the RFP itself is a very complex document, especially because we have so many quality measures we are asking about now. So we had extensive interaction with Department of Justice throughout the development of the RFP as vendor questions came back, and we put responses back out together. And as we will now move into the selection and then the eventual contracting process, we have, especially with on the contract side, we have a lot of interaction with the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Also, as we brought in PEBDOT benefits, the statewide benefit management system, that did create short-term budget impact because funds were included for development. And then from here on out will be for maintenance of the system. Page 26, there was $500,000 of the cost of PEBDOT benefits were funded through a certificate of participation issued in 2003. Currently, that is budgeted. It's in Information Resource Management Division with us transferring that money to IRMD. DAS is proposing a technical adjustment to just move that the expenditure of debt service from IRMD to PEB, so it's directly out of PEB. In terms of the spending history, and I would say, if we could focus for a moment on the bottom, which is the limited, because I need to explain the non-limited. The limited, you'll see in 2003 was $2.3 million. The expenditures that were occurring in 2003 for the development of PEBDOT benefits was actually in the budget for Information Resource Management Division. So there was about $1 million that was there instead of in our budget. So part of what you see, the difference between 2003 and 2305, was just moving those expenditures directly into the PEB budget. On the non-limited funds, that is primarily the stabilization fund. It is the stabilization fund. And those revenues, we receive revenues from if a person opts out because they have other group coverage, they get a certain amount of money back. A certain amount of money goes into the stabilization fund. That's the primary source of revenues there. We also may have refunds. For instance, if someone had a dependent care account and didn't use up all of their money at the end of the year, that goes back into the account. To this point, that's actually paid the administrative costs of operating our flexible spending accounts. And then the wellness revenues that I mentioned. I would say that the 0305 legislatively approved for non-limited was far beyond where we actually will find ourselves. Normally, the stabilization fund in the past had been used to provide some subsidies for part-time or rural subsidies. There was $15 million that has been transferred out of the stabilization fund in 0305 to support general fund costs of employee health insurance. The board really is hoping to grow the stabilization fund. Those are our reserves for allowing us to do self-insurance. So we're projecting that currently we do not have any subsidies coming out of the stabilization fund, and that if that continues, by the end of this year, we should have about $41 million in the stabilization fund. In terms of projections for 05-07, basically these numbers were based on looking at a number of past years. To the degree the board does self-insure, it will be taking on some risk. And so it's unknown at this point whether we'd be spending any of the reserves to cover claims costs or not. So we're just it's too early in the process. We don't know who we'll be contracting with, how many of those contracts may be on a self-insuring basis, and then what kind of claims experience we'll have in the long term. As we move to page 28, as you see on the limited side, a slight increase from 3.8 or 3.9 to 4.1. Continue the core functions, includes some modifications to PEBDOT benefits, which I'll get to in a moment. I take it you don't want to talk about base budget adjustments.
Yeah, at the committee's pleasure, we can go through those detailed packages if you'd like.
I think we can read them, and if anyone has any questions, we know you're there as a resource.
Page 31, we are, as we've been going through, building PEBDOT benefits. Of course, as you move along, you see, oh, it could be a little more efficient if we did this or did this shortcut or put this in so we have fewer keystrokes. So there are about 12 modifications that have been identified so far that once we have it up and running, we want to go back in and again make the system just that much easier and that much quicker to use. So that is our one policy package that we have this time. In terms of performance measures on page 35, we do have an employee satisfaction survey. It's tied to our open enrollment process, and so since we haven't had mandatory open enrollment over the last few years, we have not had a very high response rate. We do think as we move to PEBDOT benefits, and especially if we end up having mandatory open enrollment this year, likely what we will do is have a step in the process be completing a survey. So it will give us a higher response rate so we can feel more comfortable with the we've had good results, but I think only 600 or 800 surveys returned, for instance. We have contract performance standards that our insurance carriers need to meet. Currently, those have been focused on administrative measures such as percent of clean claims paid, how quickly they pay the claims, how quickly they answer their phones. I'll get in a moment into some things we want to add. And then we have the DAS statewide satisfaction survey. One performance measure that I believe we can discontinue because it's been the same every year is the administrative assessment. We are paid there's a 0.6% of premium that actually pays for PEB operations. We have a statutory limit of 2%. We've been at 0.6%, I think, since the time PEB was formed. Don't really think that has much meaning. But when we talk about performance measures that should be adopted, as we're looking more at value-based purchasing, we think we need to be looking beyond our administrative processes and really saying, what are we getting out of in terms of quality of the contracts that we're letting. So we do want to look at improvement of employee health over time. As I said, we're partnering with DHS now in terms of a baseline survey of employees. There will be 2,000 employees who are surveyed, so it will give us a good, robust baseline. Also, as we are now saying to insurance contractors or potential contractors, there are certain quality measures that we want you to be reporting on, and we want to be tracking those over time, and those are certainly things now beyond the administrative measures that we need to build into our contracts. And so would expect that we will have more performance measures that tie more directly to the quality of care that the health plans are actually providing. Good. Senator Morsett.
Thank you. How many, I guess I'd like to know in general how many boards and commissions are policy board. We asked this question before. Maybe we have the information. How many boards and commissions in the state that are charged with policy, and how many are advisory? Now, you serve at the pleasure of the board. How many? Okay, that's interesting. Do you also serve at the pleasure of the governor?
Since the governor appoints the board members, it's not direct, not as I did in former positions that I was in.
So, but it's an interesting thing, and I guess it's important information, I think, for us to know. Now, the other thing is, should you bring a board? Is there a board member here?
Today there isn't.
Okay, but you would if you. Okay, that is a policy board, so you might ordinarily bring a board member that we might also address policy questions to, which is why I'd like to know the distinction. So that question isn't necessarily directed to you either. It's directed at the staff. If we could find out how many boards and commissions are policy as opposed to advisory, I'd like to know the names of the boards and commissions that are policy.
There's something in here that I think...
Well, that's right.
Sue Wilson will go over when we get to Human Resources Services in response to the question that was posed during phase one about that very issue.
Yeah, I think we raised this issue once before. So.
Yeah, I really think that we're looking globally. It isn't just within the Department of Administrative Services.
Yeah.
And Ms. Warner, will you join us?
For the record, I'm Lori Warner, the acting director for...
Why don't you get a chair?
It's not good for your...
It just pains me to see you do
that. Wellness.
The wellness thing.
If you look in the back of the in Appendix B, you did ask this question in the phase one.
Okay.
And if you go... sorry, these aren't page numbers, but if you go to... Attachment 5, Governor's Direct Appointees, which is near the back of it.
Okay.
Then there's a listing. You would ask this question. It looks like it's after the number of employees at top staff. There's this appointing relationship chart.
Uh-huh.
You see it?
Yeah.
And so we tried to list that shows the governor on the left-hand column there. The governor appoints the board, but the board appoints the agency head then.
Oh.
And then who the governor appoints directly, and then who the governor appoints, and then the Senate confirms.
Okay.
I think that at least gets you in the ballpark, and you may have some more specific questions about those relationships, but this is the roadmap I think you asked for. And then on the back of that page, you had asked about governance relationships,
mm-hmm.
about how does staff talk to state agencies, and how does the legislature talk to state agencies, and how does the governor? So this attempts graphically to show you that also, those relationships.
I think the piece we're missing, Director Warner, is what kinds of boards these are, whether they are advisory or policy. And to the degree that someone in your office, could provide that information over the course of the next 2 weeks while we're doing your hearings, it would be very helpful. ODOT, for example, has an extremely engaged policy board.
Right.
And we have learned during the course of other hearings that the real estate agency, for example, has an unengaged board, and that's the kind of information.
Okay, well, we'll try to craft that to bring it back.
Great.
This was the question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if actually by a designation it answers that question, where the governor appoints the board and then the board appoints the agency head. My guess is that's a governing board.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the case where the governor makes the direct appointments and you have a board, it's advisory.
We'll clarify that in writing.
Okay, that should actually, the governor appoints the board.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for this information, because this is
it isn't listed here.
And Madam Chair, if I might just say, we have a very engaged board, and I was actually surprised when I came to PEB at the depth of understanding and the level, the amount of time our board members really spend. And so when you asked about, for instance, whether the board would be acting upon recommendations of the staff around the medical contractors, all board members themselves are heavily engaged in reviewing of the proposals. So.
Well, and after those very laudatory comments about your board that I have every reason to believe are correct, staff points out to me you're not listed.
Oh.
So we might want to just ask that this be reviewed for its comprehensiveness, and any additional material you could provide us would be useful. I'm about to head off into something that my question will betray how little I know about this. But you have a reserve account awaiting the outcome of some litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Could you both give us the flavor of the litigation, the status, what you're holding in reserve, and what the plans are for dealing with that reserve, depending on the outcome?
The Standard Insurance Company, which holds group life insurance and disability insurance for state employees and dependents, in 1999, Standard changed from being a mutual life insurance company owned by policyholders to a stock life insurance company owned by stockholders. So it's called demutualization. I always have to have someone explain what demutualization is. PEB was considered one policyholder. It was actually PEB that held the policy, not individuals. And so there have been there's been litigation going back and forth trying to figure out where does, and at the time that this occurred, there was over $19 million that would be coming back as a cash payment as a result of demutualization. This is currently, it's at the Court of Appeals, and I believe is scheduled for oral argument later this month at the Court of Appeals. It's in an interest-bearing account in Treasury, and the last that I talked with Department of Justice about this, they assumed that once it's heard, it may be another 6 months before Court of Appeals issues a decision, and then they would not be surprised if it actually, no matter which way it goes, that it would be actually appealed to the Supreme Court. So it's sitting in a separate account with the Department of Treasury, interest-bearing account in the meantime.
And the question then is whether any of the money as a result of demutualization flows through PEB to the beneficiaries of the policy, or whether it is a single policy held by PEB, and so instead of having many multiple beneficiaries of any outcome, the question before the court is it one or many?
Yes.
Okay. And then depending on the outcome of the case, you have this $19 million in reserve. What sort of planning around that reserve is there? Let's assume that the decision is that there is one case. One policy.
Madam Chair, I've been with the board for a year, and we have not had discussions during the time I've been there around what might occur if it is found that it is one. And so I'm afraid I can't tell you what kinds of discussions may occur before then with the board. And so apparently the question, I'm looking at some of the last ruling.
Well, that's fine. Maybe don't try to postulate an answer now. If you want to give it a little more thought, maybe we'll do it as one of the pickup questions in our last time together. Well, this I think could. Oh, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the board, with any frequency, degree of frequency, benchmark against the private sector in terms of benefits?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, we as we go through reviews of contracts, whether it's now we've gone out for a full RFP or if we are looking at renewal discussions with current carriers, we normally have our consultants, Aon Consulting, provide information on both how we might compare with other public employers in Oregon or with private employers in Oregon in terms of benefit design, actuarial value, and cost. I do know that in terms of we were just discussing this last week, that last year when we did a renewal, the benchmarking that was done against other public, major public employers, and Aon Consulting usually looks at the city, county, and school district in Multnomah, Marion, and Lane counties, that the value of our benefit package, we get a good administrative rate, and so the value of our benefit package was about 11% more, and the cost was about 1% more. So one of the different, you'll see people talk about how much the state pays for something versus how much someone else, another company may pay, but trying to true up what's the benefit package, because it's easy to save money by just saying now there's a higher percentage of a copay, for instance, or coinsurance. So the board does receive information at least annually on where PEB is compared with, at least in Oregon, other major public employers, and then generally the private sector.
Follow-up, Senator Morse.
I believe it would be helpful to maintain a sense of equilibrium between the public sector and the private sector, to have a performance measure that creates a private sector index for total benefit costs that are paid by the employer. Exclude PERS out of this, okay, but total benefits, create that index, and then benchmark the public sector to that private sector index. Because one of the things that we continually hear is that the public sector is far above the private sector. And I think it would be helpful to, and we may intentionally do that, but to be aware of just the degree to which it may vary, and it may not. I don't know.
I think that's an excellent idea, and given that we can take no action today, I'm going to ask you if you would to take the responsibility of working with Director Thorne and the professional staff and see if you could craft a benchmark, get the right wording for consideration by the panel as we work this budget. Ms. Thorne, are you done?
I am done.
I think while we invite Mr. Foster up, we have been joined by the PAGE program, and is that not correct? And would invite all of the young people that are here today to stand up and tell us where you're from. This is the Subcommittee on General Government, and the budget that we're dealing with today is that of the Department of Administrative Services. And so do you want to start on the end, that gentleman in the blue shirt, and tell us where you're from?
I'm from.
Great. And what grade are you in?
I'm six.
Good. Have you ever been here before?
Yes.
Good. Tell us your name. Good. Well, welcome, Mr. Johnson. And what's your name?
My name is Joe Schultz.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Great. What school? Great. Okay. Well, that's excellent. Good. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. You're welcome to stay as long as you'd like. This is a budget committee where we're talking about how a state agency spends the money that they have, and we're talking about the different programs that they have inside the agency. And that's all this committee does is works on budgets, and so you're welcome to stay as long as you like. Thank you very much for joining us, and I think the young man from Banks is a constituent of mine, so a special welcome to him. All right, Mr. Foster.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Foster. I'm the administrator of the Facilities Division of the Department of Administrative Services. And I guess I'll start off on page 3, which is again stating the mission of the division, which we had covered in phase 1. Moving to page 4, in addition...
Sorry, let's make sure we're all with you.
Sure. Sorry.
Moving from the back of the book, we're under the tab that is Facilities Division, phase 2, 1 of 1, and you've now invited us to join you on page 5.
Four.
And actually, I think your numbering might be one off from ours.
Yeah, because our page 4 is blank.
Oh, sorry.
Just so you know.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
In addition to the core function of supporting the mission of DAS and other agencies, we have also been charged with supporting the major statewide initiative on the consolidating the data center by providing a facility to support that endeavor. In terms of key legislation, I believe the director had provided you an update on Senate Bill 90 that is has passed through the Senate, now is going to the House. And unless you have any other issues or questions about that.
I don't want to pass over the fact that this division is responsible for the construction of the physical facility for the consolidated data center. I think we're going to have lots more questions when we actually get to the point where we're ready to work on this budget specifically with the breakdown of Scenic. I believe that what you're telling us is you're responsible for the new physical plant and are not responsible for what goes in the new physical plant, but you're just designing a structure to house all of the equipment that will come with this consolidated data.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. And that building is now grounds broken. It's underway?
Madam Chair, it's probably at about 40 or 50% complete with a completion date of the end of June.
Senator Morissette.
Excuse me. Do you contract the architectural design?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we contract for all of the design and construction services.
Please.
Okay. You contract, put out a bid for design of the building, and the main purpose is the functionality of the design. Is that correct? I mean, that's what you're interested in, is how functional the building is going to be over a long period of time. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, are you speaking about this particular building?
Any building.
Or just any building?
Any building.
That is correct.
Mr. Foster, I was just having a sidebar consultation here with the professional staff, and one of the things that I might pose to the committee is if we continue to proceed at the pace that we're proceeding, because this will bring us back on time, today's meeting, whether or not we could arrange a tour of the new building. I think we're going to be spending a lot of attention on the actual Scenic program, and it would be the most useful if we arrange a tour to have you as the facilities person, the person accountable, as well as the program manager for the actual consolidated data project. And so I'm going to ask Dallas to work with Director Warner and her staff to see if we can find a time when we could go out and look at this facility.
And we could use a committee.
Yeah, we'd use the committee time to do that, and and perhaps look at a couple of the agencies whose material, whose processes are being consolidated there, and but mostly to see the new facility and then to understand a little bit more about the value of the project as it moves forward.
Madam Chair, we would be happy to do that.
Thank you. So that's an incentive. You get a field trip if we keep moving ahead. Okay, Mr. Foster.
Again, Senate Bill 90, and I'm sorry, I made a mistake of pulling out some of the blank sheets, so my reference numbers are off. I believe we have covered that, unless
yes,
there's any other questions
ahead,
about that. The professional services and purchasing contracts, we do all of our design and construction by contract. We also do a significant portion of our maintenance work by contract. So there are a number of examples of different contracts, from elevators to window washing to involved with what we do. So,
in the main, how often are those contracts refreshed? How often do you rebid them? Thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy your day in the Capitol.
Madam Chair, the contracts for design and construction are typically on a project-by-project basis. Those for some of the maintenance services are typically done on a biennial basis.
May I ask?
Senator Morser.
I believe that public art is a part of each public building, is that correct? And how do you determine what conversation piece you're going to put out in front of a building? Because good public art has to be a conversation.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, the process for selecting art is set by the Arts Commission. The actual budget for it is incorporated into the individual projects as 1%. But the setup of the committee and the process for doing that and how that's set is administered by the Arts Commission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on to program improvements and cost containment, we do lots of preventive maintenance to try to...
Mr. Foster, I'm going to take you back one more page, if you don't mind, back to the janitorial contracts or qualified rehabilitation facilities. Could you describe a little bit how those contracts work? Because it is my understanding, which could be erroneous, that these are not necessarily based on lowest price. But would you describe for the panel a little bit the benefit of them and why they're important?
Madam Chair, the qualified rehabilitation facilities are basically organizations that provide employment for disabled folks of one kind or another. And basically the way things are set up, if we are not doing this with our own staff, they're next in line for providing the services. And yes, sometimes that is probably more costly than what we would provide if we did it ourselves. But it's certainly a social value that's in the statutes.
Madam Chair.
Senator, Representative Ivakian.
Could you explain a circumstance in which you would not use the regular state employees and use the QRFs instead?
Madam Chair, Representative Ivakian, there's, for instance, the Department of Human Services has put a high value on doing that as a furtherance of their mission, and so they requested that we use QRFs to do the custodial services in their building. That's one example.
I guess maybe the follow-up question is, they requested it. How does that negotiation occur? Because ordinarily there would be public employees doing that work, and now you invite in a qualified rehabilitation facility contract. How's that aspect of the transaction negotiated or worked out?
Madam Chair, it gets a little complicated, but where we were able to do that was by timing it when another new building was coming online that we needed custodians for, that we just moved them over into that other facility and then contracted for the one that was already complete.
With the qualified rehab facility?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Morissette. Thank you.
A couple interims ago, I was on the audit committee, and we spent considerable time discussing the definition of disabled. And have there been any challenges to that category of employees by any particular nonprofit? I don't know if the nonprofit agencies are the one. St. Vincent de Paul in Portland, for instance, has there been a challenge to the definition of disabled who would qualify for that program? That was a hot budget item or ticket item for some people.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, not to my knowledge, but I am not totally up on
well, I'm not
all
raise
the details
that
of it.
It has been brought before.
Okay, thank you. After these questions, so if you can remind us where we are in your presentation, I think you've just started program improvement and cost containment.
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the areas that we try to focus on to avoid future costs is a good preventive maintenance program. We try to use the private sector for contracting when that's cost effective. We look to value engineer the and look at the life cycle costs of materials and components in buildings. We're contracting with the Salem Transit for some of the park and ride service. At one point, we had been doing that ourselves.
I'd like to go back to the preventive maintenance piece of this, because I understand that you are charged with taking care of a certain portfolio of buildings that are owned by the state.
Yes.
You have agencies that are in long-term rental agreements. There's the whole university system that's outside of your purview. But if I understood Director Warner correctly, she said that it was DASA's responsibility or part of their mission to help provide direction and leadership and guidance to parts of state government. To what degree do you interact with the university system to give them any kind of guidance about preventative maintenance? Because it stuns me when I look at the amount of deferred maintenance that they've accumulated on the books while simultaneously building as though there's no tomorrow, and you've got other older, perfectly serviceable buildings crusting into decay because nobody pays any attention to them.
Madam Chair, there had been some relationship and discussions with the Oregon University system prior to them being kind of moved out from under a lot of the purview of certain aspects of the statutes. And since that time, we really do not engage. They're handle that themselves. We deal with coordinating and an overview of the other state agencies.
How much then, in your bookkeeping processes, how much deferred maintenance do you have on the books?
Madam Chair, we, through our statewide program, we have a listing from each of the agencies. I don't have that number with me for other agencies. Our list for the Department of Administrative Services is basically nothing.
One last question then. ODOT owns their own building, and for a number of years I worked in and around that building, and that building is tired and neglected. And now we're looking at pretty substantial costs to rehab it, and I understand that there are certain modernization things that are necessary, but I also question who then, for the buildings that are owned by the agencies, is responsible for sort of keeping their finger on deferred maintenance to make sure that we're not costing the taxpayers money through neglect of this important aspect of building ownership?
Madam Chair, the program that is, you know, slowly maturing that we have through the Capital Projects Advisory Board, has created a mechanism where the individual agencies have to report each biennium to the board about the status of their facilities and what their needs are. Now, as far as what follow-up comes from that, that information is made available, but I think that's really kind of the extent of it right now, is collecting the information and sharing it and making recommendations as to what might be good and proper professional management of the facilities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You gave me a great idea for a bill to require all public agencies throughout the state of Oregon to annually report to their boards on the status of their buildings, because school districts are notorious for deferred maintenance. And I think that is that would be a great check on that.
And if you include the university system, I'll vote for it.
Okay. Thank you, because I think that's really important that the board know and that the public know what the trade-offs are.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Please continue.
Let's see. The let's see which page. That's 19, isn't it? Or 18, I guess. Some of the program improvements are made continuously based on suggestions derived from our customer survey, some informal continuous quality improvement programs, and contact with building tenants to provide feedback on our service delivery. Some of the minor cost items that we have done here of late are listed there as well. And one that I think is a good example that of some of the kinds of things that we've been trying to look closely at is the use of a limited license rather than a journeyman electrician to do certain parts of our maintenance work. It's a different level of pay, and yet they're perfectly capable of doing that work, and so we can experience some savings by matching the type of employee a little better to the work that's being done. And, of course, the resource conservation program that we have continues to keep our savings moving along on that front. And since 2001, there has been a moratorium on lease relocations and some restrictions on furniture purchases that have resulted in some savings across the state government. We use a variety of means for evaluation, including continuous monitoring of the division's budget and to work with an interagency coalition to explore options and control energy costs. As far as a summary of the budget, some of the drivers are that, in fact, after experiencing several years of fairly flat market in construction, there's been a pretty good jump in inflation, and the Engineering News Record index increased almost 10% in 2004, and we're seeing that on some other fronts. Utility rates with some of the issues with PGE continue to be uncertain. And we more and more see a becoming part of a more national marketplace with natural gas than what it used to be. In our budget, we're seeing some increases or new debt service for the proposal on the transportation building, the Department of Environmental Quality Health Laboratory that's currently in design, the computer network and infrastructure consolidation project that we talked about, and there was a special project where we're really trying to help the military department leverage some future federal funds by temporarily taking ownership of the Ochoco OIA facility.
To what end? What will you do with it?
Well, it's we're turning around and leasing it to military for the cost, but what they can do in the future is gain some federal funds to acquire it and to renovate it for use as an armory. The fees and assessments on the next page. Actually, there's an error on the assessments for 0507 of approximately $600,000. There was a double counting of some debt service. So those are fairly equivalent between the two biennia. Spending history, the 0103 biennium shows an extremely large amount of debt service. There was a major refinancing that caused that to swell that particular biennium. And we're the projects that were listed were adding the difference, most of the difference there on the debt service for 0507. The spending history between 0305 and 0507, we moved from $62 million to $72 million. And on the following page, we're basically flat in terms of positions. The prior to the 2003 session, we realized that the methodology that we were using to look at the different kinds of rent programs that we had were not maybe allocating the costs in the way that they fully should. And we have three programs. We have uniform rent, we have self-support, and we have service agreements. And the staff that are servicing those buildings are commingled. And it got us working on reviewing carefully how those were allocated amongst them. Knowing that we needed to do some work. Well, the outcome of this is that when we set the uniform rent rate in January of 2004, it was based on some of the analysis that had been done late in 2003, and consequently the benefit of some of these real actual expenses and the benefits of the reallocation that we talked about had not happened. So what it amounts to is that as we've done some additional work and looked at ending balances, we can actually offer to reduce the uniform rent rate for 0507. And on the following slide, we've shown how that breaks out.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Next slide is our revenue by source, which I mentioned, uniform rents, self-support, the service agreements, which are the major ones for the operations and maintenance program. We have parking fees. We have a small amount of assessments, the fees for the real property services and land sales, and a few other revenues. Expenditures are 87% are operations and maintenance, and then the lesser percentages for the other programs. The governor's recommended budget continues core functions. It transfers the Ochoco Youth Authority facility that I mentioned to DAS for the benefit of the Oregon Military Department, and it adds staff to service and maintain the Department of Environmental and Health Laboratory. Also provides for 15 capital construction projects.
I think we'd like the list of those projects, if you don't mind, and the cost.
Just a really quick question. I know time is of the essence. Yesterday in the Oregonian, there was an article about the acid rain coming down the Columbia Gorge in the winter. I don't know if you saw that article. The main cause of that is the coal-fired plant at Boardman, and it is causing serious damage. Now, is the Environmental Quality Health Division lab
some issues?
Does that have anything to do with those kinds of things?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there it's the laboratory that they do the analytical work in for the Department of Environmental Quality.
Well, it should have something to do with that. That's a serious problem for Portlanders.
I apologize. The
anyone
list
else on the Columbia Gorge downwind from that site?
The list is here, and we're going to have considerably more conversation over the capital construction. So.
Okay. The next slides are on the essential packages, and unless there's some particular questions about those,
I think we're going to pass on those. Ms. Parker's here as a resource.
So with that, we'll move to the capital improvement. Now, the capital improvement is those kinds of critical component replacement and asset protection projects that cost less than $500,000, and they're included in the operating budget of the department. For 03-05, it was $4.7 million. For 05-07, we're proposing $4.4 million. The projects break down into $300,000 for emergency projects, $1.4 million for roof, electrical, heating, ventilating, and air conditioning.
Let me stop you. What constitutes an emergency project?
Madam Chair, what we typically have been doing for numbers of years is including a line item that would allow some unanticipated failure of equipment that would become a capital expense that we needed to put in there. And we don't go into the biennium with any sense of what that's going to be. It's to give us a little bit of flexibility. $500,000 for tenant improvements, $325,000.
Okay, stop you there. Yeah. $500,000 for tenant improvements. Do you have the specifics on this?
Again, this, Madam Chair, this is kind of an allowance, if you want to put it that way, for needed improvements that would have to occur in the event we have some agencies moving in and out of the building that we weren't aware of. So it's a little bit of a contingency fund for unanticipated issues.
Thank you.
$325,000 for the Portland State Office Building fourth floor reconfiguration.
And who's housed in there?
It's a number of small boards.
This is where the Women's Commission is, and
let's see. Off the top of my head, I'm not remembering what the whole group
That's
of
fine.
Them are, but it's numbers of small boards.
And we, as the state, rent this space from Portland State?
Madam Chair, no. This is the Portland State Office Building that the Department of Administrative Services owns. And
oh, I'm
leases.
Sorry. Portland State as in?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes. $975,000 for mall grounds and parking improvements, $552,000 for carryover, and this is just that with the capital improvements, there's a line where the spending ends at the end of the biennium, and if a project isn't quite through, we need to carry it over, and that's the limitation to deal with that. $263,000 for building clean and seal, and $100,000 for the Readiness Center communication tower.
I'm just curious, going back to the office building, floor reconfiguration. This is a lot of money. Why are we doing this?
Madam Chair, this particular project, actually, we're putting limitation in our budget for another agency that will be providing the funding. The Board of Nursing and the Board of Pharmacy are involved in some, they need some additional space. They're needing to move to other parts of the building, and this is to cover those costs.
Representative Avakian.
May I ask the same question with regard to the next one down, almost $1 million for mall grounds and parking? Just curious where that money is going.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, that includes several different smaller projects within it. The bulk of it is toward resurfacing two of our parking lots, one at the executive building and the other at the Portland State Office building. With that, I'll move to the capital construction.
Actually, I think we're going to stop here. With your permission, we've got just a couple of minutes to go. This is an obvious break point. We're now, again, officially behind. We'd ask you to return tomorrow morning and finish your presentation. And then, Dallas, if you want to just give us a preview of the agenda for tomorrow.
Okay, let's pull up my schedule. Tomorrow we'll finish up with facilities division, and we will have the Human Resource Services Division and State Services Division. Human Resource Services Division may be able to answer some of the questions you've been asking about fringes and the like, or help us with that. State Services Division will include risk management, fleet, procurement, and the like. And if we catch up, and then I might, with your permission, we could look towards arranging the tour for next Tuesday.
That sounds just fine.
To go, you see what one of the facilities looks like, maybe one of the data centers, and then we'll go take a look at the new one rather than go to all three, just to get a flavor for the difference, the dramatic difference in what the housing of the facility.
Great, and I think what we might look towards, Dallas, is that the most economical way to do this, if we take our own cars and just share, or figure out the least expensive way to do it.
We have a wonderful relationship with DAS on this.
And they
even provide the drivers.
Good. Well, just a cost is an issue, and I just want to be mindful of that.
And we can't get the governor's big 40-foot rig to...
There you go. We'll have asked for that specially.
Yeah.
All right. Any comments from the panel, such as it is?
I'm just glad that us falling a little behind didn't endanger the field here as of yet.
Then without objection, I am going to close the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5501, the Department of Administrative Services. Invite Mr. Foster back tomorrow to finish his presentation. And without objection, we are adjourned until tomorrow morning at 8:30.